Welkom bij het college Politicologie. Ik heb nog nooit zoveel ook andere studenten in de collegebanken gehad, dus van harte welkom bij dit college. Tegelijkertijd, voordat iedereen denkt van zit ik wel goed, dit college heeft zometeen ook een bijdrage van Nick Clegg over Brexit. En dat is natuurlijk ook het hoogtepunt waarvoor velen zijn gekomen. Dus je zit in dat opzicht goed, maar het is en blijft een college. Dus we gaan eerst beginnen, een eerstejaarscollege, bachelor bestuurskunde. We gaan eerst beginnen met een klein stukje over multilevel governance en wat nou zeg maar Europa zo al doet. Dit om zeg maar ook de studenten een beetje up to speed te brengen en daarmee de gelegenheid te bieden om zo dadelijk misschien een paar hele scherpe vragen te stellen. Nou, voordat ik met mijn college begin, en dat sluit zo meteen hopelijk allemaal heel mooi aan, wil ik graag een paar dingen kwijt. Dit college, met ook zeg maar de bijdrage van Nick Clegg, is georganiseerd door een aantal partijen. Onder meer het Montesquieu Instituut, de Stichting Europa Lezing en de Universiteit Leiden, waar u te gast bij bent. Dus van harte welkom bij deze drie in deze zaal van Leiden. Mijn naam is Bernard Steunenberg. Ik ben hoogleraar hier bij de opleiding bestuurskunde. En een van de dingen die ik onder meer doe is zeg maar zo'n college politicologie verzorgen. Natuurlijk ook met vakken rondom Europa. Even een paar huishoudelijke mededelingen. Terwijl iedereen op zoek is naar een mooie plek. Het college. Kijk, het verkeerde college klaarblijkelijk. Het college is in het Nederlands. Nick Clegg spreekt zometeen zijn reden uit in het Engels. Hij gaat ook antwoord geven, hoop ik, op hele mooie vragen in het Engels. Mocht u toch zeg maar wat twijfel hebben over uw Engelse vaardigheden, schroom dan niet om de vraag in het Nederlands te stellen. Maar het antwoord komt in het Engels. Dus dat even zeg maar de spelregel. Ook nog even voor iedereen hier in de zaal. Het college wordt opgenomen en onder meer gestreamd hier beneden, maar ook door NPO Politiek uitgezonden. Mocht u daar heel veel bezwaar tegen hebben dat u op een gegeven ogenblik als hoofd hier in de rijen zit, dan kunt u nu nog de zaal verlaten, want dan wordt u niet opgenomen. Maar dan ga ik er wel vanuit dat iedereen die blijft zitten daarmee instemming heeft gegeven met het feit dat er opnames gemaakt gaan worden en dat u kans loopt in beeld te komen. Dat even zeg maar terzijde. Dat zijn alle huishoudelijke mededelingen. Dan gaan we beginnen. Nou, het college is zo vormgegeven. Ik praat voor pak een beet 20 minuten, 25 minuten, misschien 30. En dan komt de bijdrage van Nick Clegg. Dat hopelijk loopt mooi over. Dus het routepad is dat we eens even kijken van hoe werkt Europa nu. Heel bazaal. Wie is dat? De Europese Unie, is het nou een federale eenheid of niet? We gaan even kijken naar de vraag van hoe komt nou zeg maar Europese integratie tot stand? Waar ligt dat aan? Waarom krijg je steeds meer Europa? Om eigenlijk te besluiten bij een mooie tak van sport die je vaak tegenkomt, referenda. En ook over Europa zijn in de afgelopen jaren heel veel referenda geweest. Opvallend is dat nee, in welke vorm dan ook, maar zelden voorkomt, maar altijd zeg maar een enorme schok tot gevolg blijkt te hebben. Dan komt Clegg. We gaan met hem ook in debat. En tenslotte is hier nog voor de studenten en al degenen die hier een smartphone bij zich hebben mogen meedoen, maar je valt niet in de prijzen, een Kahoot om hun zeg maar kundigheden op dit vlak nog eens even zeg maar te toetsen. En voor studenten zit daar ook nog een halve punt in te verdienen voor het tentamen van de vak. Goed, hoe werkt Europa? Nog even zeg maar de instellingen op een rij, want ja, dat is altijd toch wel belangrijk om daar op te letten. We hebben zeg maar om te beginnen de Europese Raad, dat is zeg maar de politiek-strategische bijeenkomst van de leiders van de verschillende landen, de heads of states and governments, zoals het zeg maar mooi heet in het verdrag. Maar ja, politiek-strategisch van aard. Dan komen er twee anderen, die zeg maar, vanuit zeg maar, het oogpunt van wetgeving veel interessanter zijn. Dat zijn de Raad van Ministers en het Europees Parlement. Elk met eigen bevoegdheden, elk met een eigen rol. Waarbij de Raad van Ministers een bijzonderheid kent dat daar steeds andere personen bij elkaar zitten. Die afhankelijk van het onderwerp in Brussel bij elkaar komen, onder meer. Wetgevend. Je hebt daar de gewone, de ordinary heet het, de gewone wetgevingsprocedure die de Raad zeg maar een belangrijke actor maakt. Maar daarnaast kent het verdrag ook allerlei andere bepalingen nog waarin de raad zeg maar wetgevend kan optreden. Dus in die zin is de raad zeg maar een hele belangrijke actor wanneer het gaat over wet en regelgeving die uit Europa komt. Zij staan daar vaak aan het stuur. Ze kennen het rolerend voorzitterschap. Alleen daar is ook nog heel veel mee aan de hand. Dat betekent dat eens in de zes maanden een land zeg maar trekker is. Bulgarije bijvoorbeeld op dit moment. En dat rolerend voorzitterschap, dat geldt voor de meeste raden of configuraties van de raden, behalve zeg maar de raden op het terrein van buitenlandse beleid. Want dat, daar hebben we een vaste kracht voor ingehuurd. En dat is zeg maar de hoge vertegenwoordiger van WDE. En dat is mevrouw Mogherini die dat op dit moment doet. Het Europees Parlement, dus ook een parlement in Europa. Dat is een parlement met gekozen vertegenwoordigers uit die lidstaten. Een zittingstermijn van 5 jaar, wetgevend in het kader van de gewone wetgevingsprocedure. En met ook weer nog iets verwarrends voor menig Nederlander. Er zitten politieke partijen in het Europees Parlement. Alleen die partijen zijn niet altijd zeg maar partijen zoals wij dat in Nederland kennen. Het heet de partijgroeperingen. Ze vormen zich vaak na zeg maar de verkiezingen van weer een nieuwe Europees Parlement. Een nieuwe termijn waarin zeg maar dat parlement bij elkaar komt. En dan is met name voor kleine partijen het even de puzzel met wie ga ik het nu doen. En dat heeft weer te maken dat politieke partijen of politieke partijgroeperingen bepaalde voordelen hebben in het Europees Parlement. Onder meer spreekrecht en het aanwijzen van rapporteurs. De laatste, niet onbelangrijk, Europese Commissie. Daar hebben ze alle vier nu op een rij. Ja, daar zitten onder meer de gezichten van de commissarissen in. Dat is het college. Maar het is ook het ambtelijke apparaat met heel veel ambtenaren. Alhoewel dat aantal valt reuze mee. Was geteld en geloof dat de Nederlandse Belastingdienst net zoveel ambtenaren heeft als zeg maar, de Europese Commissie. Dus in die zin is het een relatief kleine commissie met belangrijke initiërende en uitvoerende bevoegdheden. Daar kunnen we andere keren over praten. Met ook de verschillende DG's, de verschillende departementen, om het even in het Nederlands te zeggen, die daar zeg maar, de voorbereiding voor doen en waar die ambtenaren in participeren. Wie beslist? Nou, dat is zeg maar in Europa toch altijd weer wat lastiger dan in Nederland, waar je zeg maar, met één regel klaar bent. In Europa beslist zeg maar, het parlement met de raad onder de gewone wetgevingsprocedure. Ga je naar andere vormen toe, dan kan het zomaar zijn dat de raad alleen een besluit mag nemen. Dus in die zin is Europa niet te vergelijken met Nederland. Wat zijn de vormen waarin die wetgeving wordt gestoken? Nou, dan kennen ze in Europa twee dingen, ook weer wat bijzonder. De verordeningen zijn eigenlijk het meeste vergelijken met wetgeving die je in Nederland zeg maar, tegenkomt. Maar de richtlijnen, dat zijn zeg maar, bijzondere dingen, want die hebben wel zeg maar, een werking. Die werken naar Nederland toe. Nederland moet die omzetten. Maar die moeten eerst nog een slag krijgen in de nationale arena, in de lidstaten, voordat het wet en regelgeving is voor, laten we zeggen, burgers. Terwijl burgers wel weer, volgens zeg maar, het jurisprudentie, soms weer rechten kunnen ontleden aan niet omgezette richtlijnen. Heel ingewikkeld, maar daarmee maken die richtlijnen toch wel zeg maar, weer boeiend. Waarom richtlijnen? Omdat Europa ook wel weet dat ze niet alles kunnen regelen in Nederland of in België of in Frankrijk. Dus zijn zeg maar hybride instrumenten om tot wet en regelgeving te komen. Ten slotte nog even een kleine noot over stemprocedures. Dat hebben we ook zeg maar verschillende vormen en grootheden in. Normaliter is het toch zeg maar gewoonte om bij gekwalificeerde meerderheid te besluiten. Maar unanimiteit is ook nog steeds heel erg belangrijk. En de gewone, absolute en gewone meerderheid zijn zaken die je bij het Europees Parlement tegenkomt. U zoekt nog even een plek. Dat is vast daar nog een mooie plaats vrij. Goed. Oké. Dat maakt Europa interessant, want zodra zeg maar, besluitvorming over wetgeving is gebeurd, komt de hele handel weer naar Nederland bijvoorbeeld terug. En dan hebben we te maken met omzetten, het uitvoeren enzovoort. Kortom, Europa is in die zin zeg maar, eigenlijk iets wat heel vaak bij ons thuis gebeurt. Ze maken zeg maar, richtlijnen, daar besluiten ze over. Maar vervolgens is Nederland degene die het mag uitvoeren. Dus wij zijn als Nederland eigenlijk een groot uitvoeringskantoor van de Europese Unie. Tegelijkertijd, gelukkig praten we daar ook intens over mee. Hoe doen we dat in Nederland? Nou, dan met name voor die richtlijnen ja, die gaan gewoon in de Nederlandse molen van wetgeving of wet en regelgeving weer mee. Dat kunnen zeg maar wetten in formele zin zijn, dat kunnen ANVB's wezen of ministeriële regelingen. Hoe dat precies zit, ligt aan de mogelijkheden van delegatie die het bestaande kader eigenlijk biedt. Maar eigenlijk in Nederland zijn nogal wat wetten, maar ook andere regelingen, Europees geïnspireerd. Het zijn zeg maar vormen die passen bij de richtlijnen die in Europa zijn vastgesteld. En dan de uitvoering. Ja, dan ga je nog een stap verder. Dan kom je thuis bij de gemeente Den Haag of bij een agentschap, IND, of een andere organisatie die aan de slag gaat. Neem bijvoorbeeld het dossier over luchtkwaliteit. Daar zijn gemeenten druk mee. Is het Rijk druk mee doende? Kortom, dan wordt die uitvoering dus gedaan thuis door de organisatie die we in Nederland gewoon weer kennen. Dus in die zin is het een enorme cirkel die dan weer terugkomt bij het beginpunt. Namelijk bij ons in de gemeente, in de regio en soms zeg maar op het niveau van het Rijk. Maar wat is Europa nou? En dat is het boeiende. Mark Rutte heeft daar allerlei dingen over gezegd een aantal weken terug in een lezing die hij in Berlijn heeft gehouden. Eigenlijk zijn eerste grote Europa-optreden, dat wil zeggen dat hij over Europa ging praten. En één ding die hij daar onder meer naar voren bracht, is hoe hij tegen Europa aankijkt. En wat ik maar boeiend vind, dan moet ik even heel goed kijken, want hij zit zeg maar bij mij in de nek, is dat die trein voor hem niet onvermijdelijk is. Dus het is niet zeg maar een soort van proces met een eindbestemming. Waarbij in het debat vaak zeg maar dat elementen storten zich aan van onvermijdelijk en het wordt steeds meer insnuipt. En dat vindt Rutte zeg maar iets wat we eigenlijk niet zouden moeten willen. Nou, dat kan, maar een van de woorden die ook gebruikt is een federale eindbestemming. En de vraag die opkomt, is Europa federaal? Of is het helemaal niet federaal? Dan laten we even kijken. Ja, jullie hebben natuurlijk niet de literatuur bestudeerd, maar in het boek wat voor dit vak zeg maar centraal staat, zijn een aantal vormen van federalisme op een rij gezet. En de vraag is, waar hoort die nou bij? Is het nu 1 asymmetrisch? Is het nu 2 duaal? Of is het een van de anderen? Nou, laten we eens even langs lopen. Asymmetrisch is het niet, hè, want dan heb je zeg maar te maken met decentrale overheden die andere bevoegdheden hebben. Dat is niet Europa. Duaal, een federatie en de delen werken onafhankelijk van elkaar samen. Daar heb ik ook niet echt het idee van. Coöperatief, federatie en delen werken nauw samen. Ik geloof ook niet dat dat heel past bij de visie die Rutte laat zien. En quasi-federaal betekent dat je een systeem hebt wat eigenlijk unitair is met een paar kenmerken die federaal doen lijken. Nou, dat is het helemaal niet, want dat zou betekenen dat we eigenlijk zeg maar, als Rijk in Nederland weinig meer te zeggen zouden hebben in Europa. Nee, wat het is een confederatie, een samenwerking van staten waarbij relatief veel macht bij de leden is. Dat is de typering van de Europese Unie. En laten we daar eens even verder op inzoomen, hè, want dat is het interessante van Europa. Wat zijn die intergouvernementele elementen? Dat zijn er nogal veel. Ik heb hier een aantal voorbeelden van genoemd. Er ligt betrekkelijk veel macht nog steeds bij die lidstaten. In de wetgeving, in de manieren waarop men vervolgens met de commissie aan de slag gaat rondom de uitvoering. Dat zijn zeg maar de communautologiezaken, de mogelijkheden om mee te praten in gedeelde bevoegdheden over een groot aantal thema's. Europa heeft weinig terreinen waar ze exclusief mogen optreden. En we hebben ook nog, als laatste lood, komen we nog even op terug, de oranje of gele kaartprocedure. Zeg maar de uitwerking, de uitvoering van de protocollen die met het verdrag van Lissabon zijn aangenomen. En die nationale parlementen laten kijken naar de vraag van, is die wetgeving op Europees niveau nog wel nodig? Er zijn ook supranationale elementen en dat maakt het boeiend. Het is gelukkig niet zwart-wit, het is een beetje grijs. En die supranationale elementen zitten natuurlijk in een aantal andere zaken. We hebben wel een Europees parlement. Dat is niet intergouvernementeel. Er zijn exclusieve bevoegdheden. Handel, douane, mededingingsregels. Daar mag Europa zelf in optreden. Dat is ook niet intergouvernementeel. En je hebt de gewone wetgevingsprocedure. Waar het parlement en de raad samen met elkaar optrekken. En dat is het rare eigenlijk van Europa, dat het twee gezichten heeft. Twee gezichten die je aankijken, dat supranationale gezicht en eigenlijk naar mijn smaak ook dat grotere intergouvernementele gezicht. En af en toe kijk je er intergouvernementeel tegenaan en soms zie je zeg maar iets supranationaals zitten. Dat is Europa. Europa van twee gezichten, zou ik bijna willen zeggen. Hoe komt het dat we nou zeg maar steeds meer Europa gaan krijgen? Waar ligt het nou aan? Hoe dan het? Wie heeft het gedaan? Nou, daar is er een debat in nogal wat stukken over in de afgelopen jaren. En het is eigenlijk zeg maar nog steeds zijn twee zienswijzen op dat vlak heel belangrijk. De eerste is een hele oude, stamt uit de jaren 50, is verder ontwikkeld in de jaren 60. De tweede, laat ik zo meteen zien, komt meer uit de jaren 70. Die oude zienswijze is dat eigenlijk zeg maar Europese integratie het gevolg is van spillovers, problemen die je met beleid wil aanpakken en waarvoor je eigenlijk dat beleid verder moet uit laten dijen om dat probleem ook aan te pakken. Dus je begint ergens, je maakt beleid, na een paar jaar ontdek je er zijn nog wat problemen en die problemen wil je ook aanpakken, want dat is natuurlijk heel vervelend en op die manier wordt het eigenlijk steeds groter en groter. Dus die spillovers van dat beleid is eigenlijk volgens sommigen de motor achter integratie. Dat zie je nog steeds. Als we over de detacheringsrichtlijn praten, hadden we een oude regeling. Die werkte niet goed, die hebben we aangepast en daarmee halen we nog veel meer Europa naar binnen. Meer regels. Dus dat is eigenlijk één trek die je tegenkomt ten aanzien van Europese integratie. De tweede is de intergouvernementele visie. Die komt erop neer dat eigenlijk zeg maar, integratie gezien wordt als grote stappen voorwaarts door een aantal landen. Het is waar, zeg maar, de overeenstemming tussen, laten we zeggen, grote politici die wat willen. En dat is ook een belangrijk gegeven om in de gaten te houden. Dus integratie is dan niet zozeer het gevolg van de problemen die je wil oplossen, maar het is een gevolg van politieke keuzes. We willen dat graag. En die twee dingen bepalen, naar mijn smaak, waarom we steeds meer Europa krijgen. Het zijn zeg maar twee oorzaken, beleid en politici, die dat doen. Zijn er remmen? Waar is de noodrem? Nou, er zijn een aantal remmen die we zeg maar kunnen gebruiken, als je dat wil. De eerste komt zeg maar uit het verdrag, is de gele of oranje kaart. Protocol 1 en 2 van het verdrag van Lissabon is dan relevant. En die geven aan dat nationale parlementen daarover mogen stemmen. Die mogen bezwaren indienen, namelijk ze mogen aangeven van zijn we het ermee eens of niet. Elk parlement heeft 2 punten. En bij 33%, laten we daar maar eens mee beginnen, in een normale procedure moet de commissie gaan heroverwegen van zullen we dat voorstel nou doorzetten of niet. Moet in ieder geval een antwoord geven. Ze moeten gaan aangeven van ja, we willen dat om de volgende redenen. Er is ook een oranje kaart gedefinieerd. Die laat ik nu even zien, minder belangrijk, want die is nog nooit gebruikt. En die geeft aan dat wanneer die parlementen zelfs 50% van de stemmen weten te halen, dus 50% van die nationale parlementen trekken hun kaart uit de borstzak, dan moet zelfs de raad daarover besluiten. Dus kan de commissie niet zelf meer met een argumentatie komen zeggen van we gaan toch door. Nee, dan moeten ze naar de raad toe om die toestemming te gaan halen. En dan is de raad en het EP beide zeg maar verantwoordelijk voor de vraag van gaan we door of niet. Hoe loopt dat? We hebben ernaar gekeken in de periode 2010-2013. Nou, in Nederland hebben we 5 bezwaren van beide kamers gehad. We hebben 10 bezwaren gehad van de Tweede Kamer en 5 bezwaren van de Eerste Kamer. Heel opvallend, onze kamers geven zeg maar verschillende signalen af. Onze kamers zijn niet zeg maar op dezelfde lijn. Raar toch? Kijken we naar alle lidstaten, dan hebben we in totaliteit zo'n 260 bezwaren gehad. Maar 3 hebben geleid tot een gele kaart. Dus ondanks het feit dat we een enorme bak met bezwaren tegengekomen in Europa, zijn er maar 3 keer een gele kaart gerealiseerd. Stakingsrecht was de eerste. Toen heeft de commissie hierdoor gezegd. De tweede was het Europees Openbaar Ministerie. De commissie zei, sorry lidstaten, we gaan wel door. En de laatste was bij detachering vorig jaar. De commissie heeft ook doorgezet. En het doorzetten heeft vooral te maken dat de commissie vond dat de landen te verschillend waren in de argumentatie waarom dat niet zou moeten. Maar al met al zou ik zeggen, jammer, ongeschikt. Geen goed instrument, we gaan gewoon door, het stopt niet en daarmee heeft het eigenlijk niet zoveel betekenis. Ik denk ook dat dat langzamerhand de deur gaat worden bij veel nationale parlementen, dat ze denken van ja, jammer, dit is niet een instrument wat echt werkt. Een andere manier van remmen, of in ieder geval om de zaak goed te bekijken, is naar het eigen parlement kijken. In Nederland hebben we zeg maar een prachtige stap gezet, een paar jaar terug, om het behandelvoorbehoud in te voeren. Dat betekent zoveel dat Nederlandse parlementariërs kunnen aangeven wanneer ze met de minister graag in contact willen blijven en willen weten wat er gebeurt bij de onderhandelingen in Nederland. Dus het wordt nou een debat in Nederland. Dat is een instrument wat ook veel andere landen gebruiken in Europa. We zijn eigenlijk een beetje hekkensluiter op dat vlak, maar niettemin, we zijn dat al zeg maar een aantal jaren aan het doen. Het wordt gebruikt door de Tweede Kamer, vooral de Eerste Kamer heeft het nog niet gebruikt. En dat betekent dat op het moment dat er zo'n voorstel binnenkomt, er 2 maanden na ontvangst van dat commissievoorstel er een keuze moet worden gemaakt van gaan we dat doen of gaan we dat niet doen. En dan kan de Kamer zeggen van ja, dat gaan we doen. En dan moet die minister naar de Kamer toe, moet uitleggen wat er speelt, enzovoort, enzovoort, enzovoort. Ze noemen dan in de Kamer de wensen en de beperkingen. En dan is de bedoeling dat de minister dat op basis van zeg maar, de stemming ook in de vaste Kamercommissie dat mee gaat nemen naar de onderhandelingstafel in het Brusselse. Nou, dit is een instrument wat in ieder geval in Nederland de Kamer enorm zeg maar, goed doet informeren over wat er speelt. Eigenlijk zijn ze wat actiever geworden. Dus wat dat er gaat, denk ik dat het een hele positieve werking heeft gehad op het debat in Nederland over Europa. Dus in die zin is dat een goed punt. Of het altijd gaat leiden tot, laten we zeggen, de zin krijgen in Brussel, dat is nog even de vraag. Want vergeet niet, er zijn nog steeds 27 anderen, misschien binnenkort 26 anderen, die daar een oordeel over moeten gaan geven. Dus mijn beoordeling, die is wel heel erg leuk en zouden we meer moeten hebben. Dan als laatste, referenda. Misschien ook een beetje zeg maar, een remmer, ook een manier om zeg maar, je zin te krijgen. En hoe zit het met referenda over Europa? Gaat dat wel goed? Nou, meestal gaat het wel goed, want het gaat ook over leuke dingen. Namelijk bij de toetreding, en hier de eerste bullet points geven aan, hebben nog wat landen in Europa gezegd van ja, we willen graag meedoen. Natuurlijk praten we hier over de landen in vooral zeg maar, Midden- en Oost-Europa die referenda hebben georganiseerd met prachtige uitkomsten. Litouwen 92, Slowakije zelfs 94%. Kortom, het enthousiasme spat er vanaf om mee te mogen doen aan Europese eenwording. Bij de verdragswijzigingen zien we ook zeg maar, nogal wat referenda. Europese grondwet ging aanvankelijk best wel goed. Spanje was 82% zeg maar, hartstikke enthousiast daarover. Luxemburg 57, begon wat minder te worden. Ja, en toen kwam zeg maar, het probleem. Toen kwam het Franse nee. En daarna ook het Nederlandse nee. En dat heeft zeg maar, toch wel heel wat fronsende wenkbrauwen opgeleverd. En eigenlijk was dat het einde van dat grondwettelijke verdrag. Lissabon. Ja, de Ieren hebben daar nog dapper nee geroepen. Die mochten het nog een keertje overdoen. En toen hebben ze maar ja gestemd. Dus daar ging het ook al wel niet zo vlot meer. Ierland heeft gelukkig wel ja gezegd tegen de Fiscal Compact. Dat was het verdrag wat na de crisis gemaakt is om ervoor te zorgen dat we elkaar beter op in de gaten gingen houden wat betreft zeg maar, de uitvoering van het EMU, het Economische Monetaire Unie. En we hebben in Nederland sinds kort nog iets anders gedaan. We hebben een prachtig associatieverdrag neergehaald, althans in een referendum. Tegelijkertijd is Europa doorgegaan. Dus misschien hebben referenda toch ook weer niet helemaal die sterke werking. En dat heeft natuurlijk ook te maken dat wanneer één land nee zegt en nog weer 27 andere landen zijn die het allemaal zeg maar, wel zien zitten. Dus in dat opzicht zijn referenda op deze manier misschien wat minder handig. Nu komen we bij de uittreding, deels of geheel. Dat weten de meeste mensen niet, maar je kunt ook uit bepaalde stukjes van zeg maar, de Europese wet en regelgeving stappen. Nou, daar hebben de Denen zeg maar, een gebruik van gemaakt. Ook de Ieren zouden dat misschien willen. Lidmaatschap bij het patent, Justice and Home Affairs. En Hongarije heeft nog een poging ondernomen om iets te zeggen over vluchtelingen en de quota. Alleen dat referendum heeft het niet gehaald vanwege het feit dat het aantal opkomende stemmers te laag was. En de laatste, en daar zitten we eigenlijk voor, de fantastische uitslag die hier eigenlijk staat, dat wil zeggen de fotofinish, dat wil zeggen de voor mij bijna onbegrijpelijke uitslag die ik niet zou kunnen interpreteren, van het Brexit-referendum. Leave 51,9 en Remain 48,1%. Kortom, een uitslag, en daar gaan we straks ook over praten, die nogal wat voeten in de aarde heeft gekregen, maar die eigenlijk zeg maar bijna too close to call is. Het is bijna onmogelijk om daar een goede, ja, laten we zeggen, een gevoel van te krijgen wat nou de kiezer in dat soort gevallen zou willen doen. Ik zou zeggen, delibereer door. Maar goed, in Groot-Brittannië, en daar gaan we zo meteen over praten, heeft men besloten om daar wel gevolg aan te geven en wel te kiezen. Dapper, maar ik weet niet wat voor consequenties dat heeft. En hier is toch nog een aardige cartoon over wat het nou betekent om referenda te doen. En ja, ik denk dat dit verhaal zeg maar voor zich spreekt. I'll switch to English now, because, well, as you know, this is also the Europe lecture, again organized by Montesquieu and the Foundation Europe Lecture and Leiden University, for which we have a very distinguished speaker and guest today. He has been a member of Parliament for about 12 years. He has been a member of the European Parliament. He was the leader of the Liberal Democrats in the UK from 2007 till 2015, and was the former deputy prime, and is the former deputy prime minister of the UK. Currently, he is leader and prime member of Open Reason, which, as a society, aims to develop liberal ideas through debate and fresh thinking. And he will present his view about Britain's future outside of the EU, and what the relationships with the EU and Britain might be in the coming years. So, a very warm welcome and applause for the Right Honourable Sir Nick Clegg.
Ik ga even deze microfoon hier.
Ja.
Ik neem een glasje water nemen.
Dank u. So, that's you. And again, and this is the white, so...
Well, thank you very much for that introduction and for the timely cartoon beforehand about referenda just before I take the stage. I think we have about an hour together, and het spijt me dat ik het niet in Nederlands een toespraakje kan geven. Ik spreek Nederlands, mijn moeder is Nederlands, maar het is echt een keukentaal voor mij, dus ik kan makkelijk over ontbijt en hagelslag in het Nederlands praten, maar niet over Brexit. Maar als u een vraagje hebt later in Nederlands, ik kan het wel begrijpen, maar dan geef ik een Engels antwoord. Dat doe ik precies hetzelfde met mijn moeder. Dus, in ieder geval, you've invited me to talk about Brexit and its consequences and its effects on both the relationship between the United Kingdom and the EU and the future development of the EU itself. And I'd like to start by telling you a little story about where I was the evening before the referendum vote itself. At about 6:30 in the evening on the 22nd of June 2016, I was standing on a street corner in my then constituency. I represented for 12 years before I lost my seat, alas, last summer in a big industrial city in the north of England called Sheffield. And myself and other fellow pro-European, pro-Remain campaigners had strategically placed ourselves in a particular part of southwest Sheffield where lots of people were walking back from the bus or the tram to go back home after a day at work. And we were saying to people, we had balloons and pro-European paraphernalia and all the rest of it, all the stuff that you'd expect during a campaign. And we were saying to people, please remember, there's a vote tomorrow, please vote. Remember to go to the polling station. Please remember to vote Remain, and so on. And at one point, a very big, large fellow crossed the street towards me. I knew him. I'd helped one of his daughters, who had learning difficulties. I'd helped her, as her local MP, get to a specialist school a couple of years before. So we knew each other, and he waved to me, big tattoos on his arms. He was a self-employed builder. And he said, hello, Nick. And I said, hello. And I said, how are you going to vote tomorrow? And he said, Brexit, of course. And I said, oh, no, you don't want to do that. And, oh, well, first he said, by the way, he said, oh, don't worry, you're going to win anyway, which which is a revealing insight into how expectations play a huge role in how people vote. But then he said something to me, which has stayed with me ever since. And he said to me, he said, oh, come on, Nick. He said, you can't ask me to tick a box next to remain, as if everything should remain the same. He said, for the last 8-9 years, I have been working longer hours than I ever have done for less pay. Every week, every month, I work longer hours, and yet every week, every month, I take a little bit less money home to help my family, to help my elderly parents, to help my kids. And it's your fault, you wretched politicians, and the bankers in the City of London who screwed up in 2008, and the regulators who didn't keep an eye on them. And I'm suffering. And this has been going on for 8-9 long years now. And you want me to just sort of tick a box and says remain, carry on as before? No way. Anything is better than this. And I remember vividly at that point thinking, well, of course I could try and explain to him that that an open economy such as the United Kingdom, leaving, unplugging itself, retreating from the world's largest borderless marketplace, is hardly going to make things any better for him. But I didn't even bother because I realized I'd lost the emotional argument. His heart, and by the way, in elections, the heart is a much more powerful organ than the brain. We spend most of our time using our brain at election times to justify something that our heart has already decided for itself. His heart had already long time decided that he was going to use this opportunity to reject a status quo which was treating him unfairly. And the reason I tell you that story is that the first thing you must remember about the referendum in the United Kingdom on our membership of the European Union is that actually it had almost nothing to do with the European Union itself. In fact, what that referendum did, which is what generally happens in referenda, is it held up a mirror to the country itself. And just to illustrate or emphasize the point even more, of the hundreds, possibly thousands, of Brexit voters that I met in South Yorkshire and Sheffield in those weeks running up to the referendum, probably the most frequently cited reason that I was given when I asked people why they were voting Brexit was immigration. Immigration, for better or for worse, I'll come to that in a minute, had become a huge preoccupation in the public mind and had become conflated in the public mind with the debate about our membership of the European Union. But the second biggest reason, guess what, was Sheffielders telling me that they were going to vote for Brexit because they were fed up with the way that Sheffield was constantly being told what to do by London. So Sheffield voters voted against Brussels to prove a point against London. And it's important, in a sense, to understand that what has happened in British politics wasn't invented in Brussels, wasn't about this directive or that directive or the common agricultural policy or how the Eurozone is constructed. Actually, it was a convulsion, an eruption of discontent, which I would argue was, if not exclusively, very largely homegrown. And what the referendum revealed, it pulled back a layer, if you like, it's like pulling back a kind of covering. And underneath, what you discover is all sorts of very profound imbalances which have been developing in British society for a very long period of time. Huge differences, cultural, economic and social differences between London, the capital city, and also Scotland and Northern Ireland, which were the three principal areas that voted for Remain and the other parts of the country. Big differences between urban and rural constituencies. Big differences between how those people with a university education voted overwhelmingly for Remain and those who don't, who voted overwhelmingly for Brexit. Between the rich and the poor. And crucially, perhaps most importantly of all, this profound generational distinction where young voters between the ages of 18 to 24 voted in pretty large numbers. Turnout is estimated for young voters between the ages of 18 to 24 at over 60%. which is not as high as the turnout for some of the older cohort of voters. The oldest cohort of voters, the turnout was over 90%. It's extraordinary. But those younger voters who did vote in large numbers, over 70% of them voted for Remain, whilst, of course, older voters did the reverse. So all of those great divisions and tensions within British society all came to a head in that referendum. My own view, but I can't prove this to you, is that of the most immediate factors, the one that is by far the most important is the one that friend of mine, that builder, that tattooed builder, told me about, which is the pain and anger which ensued from the 2008 financial crisis. My hunch is that if the 2008 financial crisis had not happened, I personally don't think the United Kingdom would have voted for Brexit. I actually don't think Trump would have been elected as President of the United States either. I think it is almost impossible to exaggerate how economically and politically significant the 2008 financial crisis has been, because it was not only, of course, economically disastrous, and particularly for a country such as the United Kingdom, which had this massively oversized financial sector compared to our GDP. I remember when I became Deputy Prime Minister that a expressionless official from the Finance Ministry said to me, Deputy Prime Minister, you must understand that the full liabilities of the British banking system are equivalent to 5 times the size of the whole British economy. And there was this silence and the sort of blood drained from my face as I realised that it kind of didn't matter what my dreams were about what we were going to do in government. Our primary task was to defuse this bomb we were sitting on of this terrible sort of toxic debt and liabilities in the banking system. So I think it is impossible to exaggerate how important the ensuing anger was of that man and many millions of people like that who quite rightly felt and feel that they are innocent victims, innocent bystanders, collateral damage, if you like, of a disaster, an economic disaster, the likes of which we probably haven't seen, certainly not in the British economy, since the oil crash in the early 70s and possibly going even further back to the Wall Street crash in the 20s and 30s, and feeling that they are having to shoulder the pain and the difficulties of an economic catastrophe which they were not authors of. So I think the 2008 crash is singularly important. But there's one other thing that I want to highlight to you, and it is this, is that I think what is very difficult to explain, particularly to folk in other European countries outside the United Kingdom, is how shallow the roots of European identity proved to be in the United Kingdom. I mean, if you think about it, the referendum pulled up the roots, like pulling out a plant out of sort of soft earth, very easily. It was a bunch of liars, Farage, Johnson, a bunch of very aggressive vested interests in the right-wing newspapers, this flippant gamble by David Cameron to basically settle an internal argument within his own party, where he assumed breezily that the result would easily be won in favour of Remain. And so I think one of the interesting questions is, why is it that even though the United Kingdom had been a member, if not always a comfortable member, but nonetheless an important, and I would argue leading member of the European Club for 4 decades, how is it that it was so easy to pull up those roots? And I think one of the reasons is because the psychological and emotional conditions in which the United Kingdom became a member of the European Club, of the European Community in the first place in the early 1970s, is very, very different to the emotional and psychological circumstances in which other member states have joined the European Club. Here in the Netherlands, my mother's now 81, particularly for older Dutch people, but also for all of the founding member states, France, Italy, Germany, Benelux. The creation of the European Community, of course it was about the Common Agricultural Policy and the European Coal and Steel Community and so on and so forth. But actually what it was emotionally, above and beyond everything else back then, was peace after war. You know, on 2 shattering occasions in a very short space of time, our continent was drenched in blood. and European integration was this extraordinary, spectacular, and in my view, remarkably successful attempt to make war in our fractious continent unimaginable. In other words, there was a very powerful, positive, emotional association with those early steps towards European integration. If you speak to folk in Spain, Portugal, Greece, the later Mediterranean entrance into the European community. My wife is Spanish. My wife comes from a small agricultural town in the middle of Castilla León, and all her aunts and uncles were smallholding sugar beet farmers. And I remember vividly standing under the blazing Castilian sun many years ago in a field in the middle of the Castilian countryside, speaking to an uncle of Miriam's, Tio Julio, who has been a farmer all his life in the same part of Spain. And I'll never forget, he didn't really know or frankly care too much about what happened in Brussels or how the European community worked. But he puffed out his chest in immense pride that Spain was now at the top table of European democracies. That after the dark days of military authoritarian rule by General Franco, and you have exactly the same emotional journey in Portugal and Greece, where you also had authoritarian military regimes, joining the European club, above and beyond everything else emotionally, meant arriving at the kind of top table of modern democracies after a long period of authoritarian or indeed fascist rule. If you go to Central and Eastern Europe, even today, given the and notwithstanding the nationalistic, chauvinistic fervour that you see in the politics of Viktor Orban in Hungary and obviously in the government of Poland and so on, notwithstanding all of that, there is still a bedrock belief that being part of the European Union is above and beyond everything else a positive, emotional statement of freedom after Soviet communism. In other words, my point is that for most other member states, the act of joining the European Union said something positive to those countries about themselves. Peace after war, democracy after fascism, freedom after Soviet communism. Britain is almost unique, certainly amongst the larger member states, of not having that positive emotional narrative about why we joined in the first place. In fact, the United Kingdom, as you will remember, in the 1950s, rather loftily and arrogantly stood aside. There are almost comic documents that you can read about rather sort of haughty, condescending Foreign Office officials writing memos to London, having observed the early moves in Messina towards European integration, which led to eventually to the Treaty of Rome and the creation of the European Community. And basically they said, well, these foreigners, they can try and do this stuff, but, you know, we're too big for that, and we have the English-speaking world, and we're recently, you know, imperial nation, and we'll let these sort of foreigners come up with this stuff. It won't lead anywhere. And then, of course, because of the economic stagnation in the United Kingdom, particularly in the 60s, there was a feeling that we should join after all. The United Kingdom then tried to join. And then General de Gaulle loftily said, no. And then we tried again, and we went back on bended knee and eventually joined in 73. And then immediately decided that maybe we shouldn't have joined. So we had a referendum in 75. But the key thing is, in that whole process of joining, it was done out of a sense of relative decline and weakness. There was nothing emotionally uplifting about joining the European community. It was more of a kind of resigned, pessimistic recognition that the United Kingdom was no longer able to stand apart. But, oh, well, if you can't beat them, you better join them. And if you read, I was obviously too young, I was only 6, 7. If you read the accounts of the referendum in the mid-70s, the whole debate was not really about national identity. There was no poetry in the debate. It was all about whether New Zealand butter might be a few pence more expensive or cheaper. It was as if the British public had been invited to take out their pocket calculator, wander into a supermarket and make a sort of specious statistical calculation about whether, on balance, after the cost-benefit analysis, it would be better to join or not. And by the way, exactly the same happened in the summer of 2016. There was no wider debate in the referendum in 2016 about what it meant for Britain's wider strategic identity in an era of globalization, as power shifts from west to east, as we all face huge supranational challenges from climate change to terrorism to global capital and so on. No, once again, if you listen to what David Cameron, George Osborne and others said, it was all endless. You know, statistical claim and counter-statistical claim. You know, X number of people might be Y pounds a little bit better off or a little bit worse off. And so I think one of the reasons why this has happened, in addition to what I've explained about the profound divisions within UK society, and most especially the effect of 2008, is that actually the United Kingdom never put down lasting emotional roots which linked British modern identity with our membership of the European Union in a way which is quite different, singularly different to other member states. So the question, I guess, now, particularly for an audience here in Den Haag, is what should the EU27, the rest of the European Union, do now that the United Kingdom has taken, in this rather haphazard way, this sudden decision to leave the EU? Because, of course, I'll come to this in a minute, it poses, in my view, profound challenges and dilemmas to the UK. But it's also a big challenge to the EU itself. Firstly, psychologically, this has never happened before. Well, I mean, Greenland, I know, left, but setting Greenland aside, no major member state has reversed out of the EU. The EU, in that old analogy that European federalists used to talk about, the European integration in the 1970s and 80s, has always been regarded as a sort of bicycle. It has to constantly move forward. And if it stops, it'll sort of topple over. And so there's always been this psychological assumption that European integration is, you know, a sort of, not quite like a sort of Maoist long march, but almost, that, you know, that it has a sort of momentum of its own. That one step of integration leads to a next. And that's why we had this frenzy of endless constitutional agitation in the European Union as one treaty led to another, to another, to another, was because there was this very firmly held belief amongst the architects and the political elites here in Den Haag and elsewhere, that European integration was a process and that it needed to continue. So it's a huge blow to the very concept of European integration that anyone should just say, well, actually, we don't want anything to do with it. We're going to reverse. That's the first profound challenge. There's also a huge economic one. Depending exactly on how you calculate GDP, the United Kingdom economy is equivalent to 17 or 19 of the remaining 27 member states. And that is a huge, it's a big economy in the family of EU economies, an economy leaving the club, which is the equivalent size to 17 or 19 of the remaining members. It is a huge economic disruption. And not to mention, of course, the United Kingdom, along with France, as the only member states with a significant military and defence capability, and with very significant assets in terms of internal security as well, that also poses profound challenges to the EU going forward in terms of the Europe's ability to act collectively in defence of its own interests. But I think the EU, so far at least, has reacted in the way that it only can. There is an argument, as some of you may have seen, certainly amongst the more kind of anti-European and excitable parts of the British press and parts of the Conservative Party, there's a sort of narrative that says, it's the EU's fault that the United Kingdom's leaving. The EU never gave the United Kingdom what it needed. David Cameron asked for a new special status within the EU, and the EU refused. And therefore, it's the EU's fault that Britain decided to leave the European Union. I think that is complete and utter nonsense. If anything, history suggests that the United Kingdom was remarkably successful and the rest of the EU remarkably generous in providing the United Kingdom with a pretty unique status. The United Kingdom was one of the principal architects of the European Union's single market, but was not a member of its single currency. The United Kingdom has all the benefits of freedom of movement within the European Union, but has not been a member of Schengen. The United Kingdom had a special exemption for a long period of time on social legislation in the European Union. The United Kingdom also negotiated for a long time a special exemption and special treatment on what was then at least called third pillar arrangements, the European Union decisions on internal security and judicial and police cooperation. The United Kingdom has taken a leading role in defence and foreign policy debates, but has always held a veto power over the key decisions in those domains. So I would argue that far from the United Kingdom not having a special status, the United Kingdom, in that phrase, I hope most of you are familiar with this, the United Kingdom had its cake and was eating it. It was, in a sense, an almost perfect balance between being a leading member but not becoming a part of some of the arrangements with which the United Kingdom was uncomfortable. And this, by the way, coincided, in my view, with a wider balancing trick which the United Kingdom has been remarkably successful at in the post-war period. And the balancing trick is this. In history, most of the time, when great powers decline rapidly, it can be a very disruptive and sometimes very violent process. As empires grow and then retreat, the retreat of empires is almost always a difficult, unpredictable, and dangerous process. The UK, after its hegemonic heyday in the 19th century, the United Kingdom was the undoubted hegemon of world affairs in the 19th century, has since then gone through a period of quite rapid retreat in the latter part of the 19th century and throughout the 20th century, where it handed over, as Harold Macmillan once famously said, as Greece was sort of handed over leadership to Rome, the United Kingdom handed over hegemonic leadership from itself to the United States. It retreated from significant colonial occupations across the world in huge swathes, particularly of Asia and elsewhere. It fought in two world wars and was on the victorious side in both. And all of that happened in a matter of decades. I mean, in historical terms, in a blink of time. And yet it found itself, after these false starts that I described to you earlier in the 50s and 60s, with a new resting place in which the United Kingdom was able to maintain its rather unique and is often called special relationship with the United States as a very Atlanticist country, an Atlanticist culture, united obviously by history, affinity, kinship and language, but was also able to maintain or develop a leading presence within the European continent through its membership of the European Community and then the European Union. So what I would argue that not only did the United Kingdom have a unique status within the EU, the United Kingdom, if by accident as much as by design, went through a remarkably intelligent process of strategic retreat in which it found a remarkably smart way of punching above its weight by maintaining this sort of Atlantic balance as acting as kind of Europe's principal Atlantic bridge. And the great tragedy, amongst many tragedies, in my view, is that the United Kingdom now, in part through its own actions, but in part through actions of others, is simultaneously losing both of those feet of that Atlantic bridge. Losing it, obviously, in Europe by removing itself from the EU, and losing it as well in America, because the American people now have a president, this kooky guy, Donald Trump, who's not in the slightest bit interested in maintaining traditional forms of Atlanticism with the United Kingdom. So I think the EU27 has responded not unreasonably at all in the way that is often alleged, but is reacting in the only way that it can, which is patiently, with sadness at the United Kingdom, or generally with sadness. I think there are some people who think it's a good thing the United Kingdom is leaving and think that de Gaulle was right, we should never have been allowed in the first place. But I think on the whole, most people in other countries think it's a bad thing for the UK and for the EU. And I think now through the negotiating process, the EU27 is quite rightly saying, look, we're very sad you're going. You've created this problem, the United Kingdom, so you have to come up with the answers. It's not us for us to come up with the answers. And our primary strategic objective now is to uphold and protect and maintain the integrity of what remains of the EU27, particularly the integrity of the core economic arrangements, the single market and the customs union, and so on. And so, I mean, there's endless commentary, probably much less so here than in the UK, on whether the EU is acting reasonably or unreasonably, whether they're being too hardline or too soft and so on. But I think so far, give or take a few missteps here and there, the EU27 has, broadly speaking, reacted in the only way that it can when a large member state unilaterally decides to leave in the way that that it does. And turning to the future, it seems to me that the EU27 has, amongst many, many, of course, there are lots and lots of challenges, from violence in the Middle East to terrorism to climate change and so on. But there are three challenges, it seems to me, for the EU of axiomatic importance. One is to rebalance and settle the profound imbalances between North and South in the single currency Eurozone. Two, to provide the citizens of the European Union with greater confidence that the mass movement of people into the European Union and across borders from one country to the next is done with greater competence and fairness and firmness than it presently is. And three, to establish a new settled relationship with the United Kingdom. And if I may just end by saying a few words on each, because I think they're all interrelated. First, on the Eurozone, you economists amongst you will no doubt have studied it in depth, but it seems to be pretty obvious that the currency union is an incomplete project. A monetary union has been created, in other words, a heterogeneous economic area of very wildly different economies have the same interest rate applied to them, and yet that monetary union has not been accompanied by a fiscal or financial union. And without repeating all, I assume, rather obvious points, that is, in my judgment, unsustainable. And as long as the Eurozone has this imbalance between the creditor North, countries such as the Netherlands, Austria, Finland, Germany, and so on, and the debtor South, and as long as, bluntly, the creditor North insists that in response to the crises and imbalances in the Eurozone, the only solution is fiscal discipline and austerity, full stop, with no mechanism for fiscal transfers, no way of providing shock absorbers, no way of pooling risk, I think it is inevitable that the Eurozone will stumble from one crisis to the next. All currency unions have profound imbalances in them. If you look at Britain is a currency union. Sheffield, the economy of Sheffield is completely different to the economy of Kent. The economy of Edinburgh is completely different to the economy of Cardiff or Belfast. You could argue that London is a country of its own, economically speaking, compared to the rest of the UK. So what does the nation state, what does it do in that circumstance? It develops all sorts of sophisticated transfer unions, welfare policies, fiscal policies, regulatory policies to try and rebalance the tensions that you get. And much though I am a great, great admirer, obviously, of this wonderful country, and much of what the Netherlands stands for, my own view is, which doesn't always make me popular with your excellent Prime Minister Mark Rutte or my fellow Liberals in the VVDs, I think in the end, the creditor North has to accept that it has to in some way underwrite the liabilities of the currency. Of course, in return for better discipline and sticking to the rules and so on and so forth. But austere discipline without some form of pooling of risk is, in my view, an unbalanced arrangement which needs to be settled. So I think, personally, I would hope that Germany, the Netherlands, others would look a little more favourably on some of the ideas that President Macron has put forward for reform of the Eurozone. Not all of them, I don't think they're all perfect. But I think he's broadly right in saying that this is an incomplete journey that needs to be completed. That's the first point. And that, I think, willy-nilly will lead to, creates a sort of dynamic of greater political and decision-making integration within the inner core of the European Union as a whole, organised around the functioning of the single currency. Secondly, on migration and immigration, the European Union is, amongst other things, suffering now from a profound mistake, design flaw, in the removal of internal borders in the Schengen area. In my view, if you're a crowded patchwork continent as we are, of lots and lots of little countries, big, small, medium-sized countries, all jostling next to each other with our different histories, different locations, and so on, you can either remove internal borders as long as you put in place external borders, or you can remove external borders as long as you keep internal borders. What you can't do, which is what happened, is remove both. Because you can't reasonably expect in a democracy people to say, yeah, there's kind of no meaningful administration at any point, either in internal borders or external borders, of how and when people come into our community and don't. That's one of the fundamental functions of the state. Not only that it keeps us safe, but it also has some kind of, at some point somewhere, some kind of say about how people come into a country or not. And so I think with hindsight, it was profoundly naive to remove internal borders and not to put in place external borders. And of course, it took the Mediterranean, the tragedy, the humanitarian tragedy of the Mediterranean refugee crisis, to bring that to the fore. And quite understandably, European publics in one country after the next have said, whoa, 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 hang on a minute. What is going on here? This is chaos. And it kind of doesn't matter what your opinions are. I have very liberal attitudes towards immigration. I'm a massive supporter of freedom of movement. I believe in very liberal and compassionate policies on asylum and so on. But I'm equally acutely aware that in a democracy, if after election after election after election after election, whether it's here or in France or in Hungary recently or in Italy recently, millions of voters are saying over and over and over and over again that they're not happy with the way in which governments are administering, the way in which we run and control our borders, you just have to do something about it. You can't continue in a democratic continent and say, well, you know, they're wrong or they're misplaced. And so I think that there is a real opportunity now for the EU27, and I would argue the EU28 with the United Kingdom as well, where we have a ferocious debate about immigration, but oddly enough, where it's as much about intra-EU immigration, in other words, people moving from particularly Central and Eastern Europe into the United Kingdom, than it is about people moving from outside the European Union into the EU. But by the way, most voters don't make that distinction. For them, it's just kind of like, is there any control over this process? How do people move in and out of our continent, in and out of our country? I think there is a great opportunity, whilst, of course, safeguarding the beauty of the freedom, one of those great four founding freedoms of European integration, of freedom of movement, of doing much more to reassure our publics that there is tougher control, where tough controls are justified, on the external borders of the European Union, if we want to maintain Schengen as it is, but also, in exceptional circumstances, an ability for member states to deploy what would in effect be an emergency brake on intra-EU immigration if that is deemed to be excessive or exceptional for temporary periods of time. And I think if the EU were to move towards a more coherent inner core organised around a reformed and strengthened monetary union, were to move more intelligently to providing reassurance that the mass movement of people into and across our European continent is being properly administered by governments. I mean, just parenthetically, everyone's very shocked that lots of people voted in Italy for the Liga, with its very anti-immigration rhetoric, and for Cinque Estrella and other populists. But what do they expect? The rest of the European Union basically expects Italy to act as the kind of shock absorber for thousands upon thousands of people coming across the Mediterranean into Italy. And there's no meaningful help given by the EU to Italy. What do we expect Italians to do? Of course they're going to rebel against that. Of course they're going to feel they're left to deal with this huge humanitarian problem without being provided with any financial or political solidarity from the paymasters in the Netherlands, Germany, and elsewhere. So I think if we were to be more coherent integration within the Eurozone, a more sustainable approach to mass movement of peoples, and, coming to my final point, there were to be a move in British politics to reopen the issue of whether we leave at all, which is not the most likely outcome, but it's perfectly possible if and when British MPs were to reject the deal presented to them by Theresa May in October, November, or December of this year, then I personally believe there is the glimmers, the sort of sketchy outlines of a new future where you have a more sustainably integrated inner core in the EU. You have a more tranquil debate about identity and immigration. And you also have the opportunity for the United Kingdom to not be in the inner core of the EU, of course not, we never were, but nor flinging itself to outer space, but instead finding a more settled status within the sort of second or third tier membership of the European Union. And one of the reasons why myself, and not just myself, why John Major, Tony Blair, David Miliband, and lots of other former this and ex that, all sort of men, unfortunately, of yesterday, why I and they continue to speak out is because we believe that with a bit of ingenuity and a bit of imagination and a bit of generosity, it is still possible to avoid the worst of Brexit. It is still possible to put European integration on a more settled basis. And it is still possible for us to travel together as one convoy rather than as a split family in this extraordinary European continent of ours. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much for this delightful speech. We have now the possibility of raising questions and hopefully getting interesting answers. For this, I would like to ask you to, that's already a hint, to briefly mention your name and keep your question as short or as brief as possible. We are going to collect a few and then give the questions to you, I hope.
Yeah.
Okay, you were the first, but yes, there we go. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Nick. My name is Faludi, but that's not the most important part. I join you in your modest hope of finding a way. However, I think reality is different, and you know that as much as I do. I left the United Kingdom after 7 years in the year that the United Kingdom joined the EU. I came to this country. And as such, I was following the post-Brexit discussion very, very closely. But you have really added many enlightening points to it. Okay. What I want to ask you is, those who are or have been frustrated and voted no, will they not be even more frustrated by the outcome? That's one. Yeah. Second one is, Will the effect of Brexit not be differential on the various parts of the United Kingdom? Will not the United Kingdom itself come under substantial strain? Thank you very much.
Okay, very good. Let's move to a next question to make sure that I'm not only taking this part of the room. There is one hand there, so maybe quick, and I'll move slowly up. Oh, wow. You raised
Hi, my name is Quinton. I had a question about, it sounds to me like the voting behavior of some of the people during a referenda is decided about dissatisfaction about subjects that aren't part of the referenda. And would that be seen as a problem? And if so, how should we approach it?
Okay, very different one. You, very brief, please.
Mr. Nicklek, my name is Khaled Ahmed Chaudhry from International Human Rights Commission. I'll not go on into the colonial era. I'll not go into the Tony Blair's WMD war. I have been always in favor of United States of Europe, a stronger Europe, a united Europe with a complete solidarity. It was unfortunate and ugliest act by the British voters who supported the Brexit. So my question to you is, don't you think that if not today, if not tomorrow, but within next few decades or years, a few more Brexits will happen due to the United Kingdom's vote, and that would be the worst kind scenario for the European generations, which deserve to live at full solidarity and prosperity. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Last question, that side of the room. Hands over there, two even.
My name is Frank Tennyson. I'm a member of the D66 European Policy Group. Here's why your vision of a multi-speed Europe with Britain on the outer ring and an inner core is not going to work, not at least not for Britain, and that is, for 500 years, the British European policy has been to prevent European unification with Britain on the outside. Now, if you expect Britain to sort of live on the periphery of a unified Europe, but abide by its rules, that is simply not going to fly with British politicians, and probably not with the British public either.
Okay. I think we did our best to make these questions as different as possible.
Right, on the first point, it's a very important issue. This 17.4 million? How many? Yes, 17.4 million people voted to leave the European Union on the 23rd of June 2016, and so you're quite right to ask, how will they feel if the argument that people like me make succeeds? In other words, aren't they going to say, well, hang on a minute, you ask us, and now, you know, you're ignoring us, and it's just like the referenda in other countries, in Ireland, and so on and so forth. And I think the answer to that is the following. One of the, in my judgment, unforgivable mistakes that Theresa May and the Conservative Party has made is that they took a remarkably narrowly decided referendum result. There was only 650,000 votes in it. Only 650,000 voters made all the difference. 650,000 voters had voted Remain rather than Brexit, we wouldn't be having this conversation now, out of a population of 66 million. They took that narrowly determined referendum outcome and then imposed upon it a very partial, one-sided, partisan and uncompromising interpretation of Brexit. If Theresa May had got up on the steps of Number 10 after she became Prime Minister, just imagine if she'd done this and said, look, I didn't want us to leave, but we're leaving. Brexit means Brexit. I will lead the United Kingdom out of the European Union because that is what has been decided, if by a narrow majority. But she could have gone on to say, but, like all Prime Ministers before me, I am mindful of the fact that I have to govern for the future, not just for the present, for our kids and our grandchildren, not just for the current generation. And therefore, yes, we will leave, but we will not leave at any cost. and I want to strike a compromise. Yes, we will leave the political institutions of the EU, but no, I want us to safeguard our place in the core economic achievements, which Britain has done so much to create in the first place, the customs union, the single market, and so on. I think most people, most reasonable people, would say, fair enough, she's trying to strike a difficult compromise on behalf of a deeply divided country. But instead, she in effect said, 16.1 million people, 16.1 million people, I think that's more than all voters in this country, 16.1 million people were on the losing side in that referendum. 16.1 million people is more than have ever voted for a winning government in the British political system. And she basically told them, we don't care what you think. You are now disenfranchised. You have no voice. We are now going to take this narrow majority, rub your noses in it, and make you voiceless. And I think it's very important, to your point, that if the pendulum were to swing the other way, we don't repeat that mistake the other way. You have to leave. One of the key ingredients of any mature democracy is that losers must not be left empty-handed. It's one of the geniuses of democracies that everybody, even when you're on the losing side, you still think you've got a stake in the game. The danger with this referendum at the moment is that the people who have lost are being told that they have no voice in British politics. So I think if the reverse happens, you definitely need to show Brexit voters that you're not simply turning the clock back and reimposing the status quo ante, that something in the meantime has changed. And my argument would be that if we were able to negotiate a new pan-European approach to immigration policy, and if you were able to introduce what is in effect a kind of emergency brake on the way in which intra-EU immigration works, I think you could then point to that and say to Brexit voters, OK, it hasn't gone all the way that you want, but something significant has changed in response to the way that you have voted. Can the UK survive as a union of countries? Well, of course, I hope it does, but I think you're undoubtedly right to say that the departure of the United Kingdom from the European Union will, of course, place, and is already placing, great strains on the way in which the union of the United Kingdom works, not least because public sentiment in Scotland was so different to other parts of particularly England, and crucially because at the moment it seems that the government is determined to create real problems in this new land border that is being created between the United Kingdom and the EU in the island of Ireland. By insisting that we leave the customs union and the single market, it is inescapable there will be new checks on that border. And as anyone who knows anything about the history of violence and terrorism around the Irish problem, the symbolic impact of even the lightest checks on that border are really very, very worrying indeed. You were asking about, you know, the fact that people, of course, voted that referendum in response to things that didn't necessarily have anything to do with the EU. I mean, to be honest, I think that's always the case in elections. I mean, elections are not... they're not academic seminars. I mean, you know, elections are rough, random sometimes, turbulent, unpredictable things where, as I say, emotion plays just as much of a role as intellect. So, I don't think we should be surprised that people use the ballot box in an expressive way. The thing that is just such a shame is that the leaders of the pro-European campaign, David Cameron and others, didn't seek to make a more emotive case for our membership of the European Union. And so all the emotion was on the other side. I mean, I remember myself, I kept the Brexit campaign had this devastatingly effective phrase, which is take back control, which was wonderful because it was as powerful as it was imprecise. And it was very seductive to people. And I think there was a systematic failure on the other side. So I'm not so surprised. I don't think you can sort of insist that people read manifestos and follow statistical debates. They won't. Of course they won't. People vote for all sorts of different reasons. Democracy is an imperfect science. It's just better than all the other alternatives. Do I think it'll have a domino effect? Well, I hope it won't. Of course I hope it won't. But to be honest, whether Brexit has a domino effect on sentiment in other countries, in my view, depends very heavily on what the EU27 now does to deal with some of these internal tensions within the EU. And my personal view is that it is running a huge risk with the long-term integrity of the European Union in not dealing with these profound north-south tensions within the current... And at the moment, I think everyone's becoming dangerously complacent because the Greek crisis kind of somehow has kind of roughly working itself out. The Irish took this really harsh medicine and have kind of swallowed it. So they did in Spain. Mass youth unemployment in southern Europe thankfully didn't lead to the political instability that some people thought. I'm afraid, and because growth in the Eurozone has been quite strong over the last year or two, I'm afraid I think there's a real complacency in particularly the kind of northern membership of the Eurozone that somehow everything's okay. It's not. The moment the Eurozone hits economic problems, which of course it will, these things always go in, the design flaws are still there. And I really worry if that happens, then of course it's much easier for populists to say, oh, to hell with the single currency, or at least to hell with the EU altogether. So I really do think it's in the hands of the EU27 to use the good times for reform. You know, it's really important to use the good times as an opportunity to do the kind of homework that you can't do when things are tough. No, I don't remotely agree with that. I'm not saying that... My vision is not that the UK just becomes a passive rule-taker. I'm not saying that the UK becomes a sort of enlarged version of Norway. What I'm saying is that the UK remains a member of the European Union. That's my vision. But in keeping with its current trajectory, where it is a full member of the European Union, but not a member of some of its arrangements, notably the single currency and the Eurozone, I think if we can supplement that with some new understandings on the fraught issue of freedom of movement, I think it is perfectly possible to square the circle. And by the way, look, the EU needs to ask itself a question. I worked in Brussels. I was an MEP for 5 years. I worked in the European Commission for 5 years. Miriam and I met the students in the Collège d'Europe. So I'm as steeped in European orthodoxy as anybody. But if European integration becomes synonymous with rigid orthodoxy, it will die. It will die. You cannot. This idea that European Union identity is only one straitjacket orthodoxy is simply not consistent with the diversity of democratic traditions and political cultures across the European. The genius of European integration is precisely that it has managed to foster unity out of immense diversity. And I really hope that the more ardent Europhile friends of mine, whether it's the D66 or elsewhere, do not take the advent of Brexit as an excuse to insist upon a kind of narrow orthodoxy of European membership, which it never had. The European Union has always been a much more fluid and elastic arrangement than all of that. And if it was ever to insist on that, I mean, just look at the problems. I mean, forget Britain for a minute. Look at the problems we've got in Central and Eastern Europe. We've got a real problem in Central and Eastern Europe. You've got a bunch of governments now who are flouting basic European Union values. And so we have a real dilemma. Of course we should insist on those values. But if you become too pure and too rigid, you'll have to kind of basically, eventually, I suppose, in extremis, kick them out. So you can create, I mean, I've heard people, particularly in parts of Brussels and Paris and elsewhere, argue that actually the big mistake was the European Union should never have allowed the UK in, as ridiculous Brits, and should never have enlarged to Central and Eastern Europe. And a purer form of European integration can be created if we retreat to the kind of old Spack, Monet, Schuman vision of a small core of much more like-minded countries. It sounds great, fine. It'll be very small, very pure, and much more irrelevant in the affairs of the world than a bigger European Union.
Well, that's something to think about. I have still space for two questions, and I would like at least have one of my students also involved. I think the young also should speak up, because it's about their future. But there's one there.
Thank you for giving this, Nick Clegg. Of course. Could you maybe elaborate more on if the United Kingdom has a chance at electoral success for a European party such as Vince Cable's Liberal Democrats in the near future to perhaps have a chance at reversing Brexit?
Okay. Second. Yep. And I'll keep the microphone.
Yep. My name's Nathan, and you hinted quite a few times about the heart over the mind. And there's been a critique raised at the Remain campaign that they didn't appeal to the identity, the cultural aspect, the value aspect, rather than the socio-economic. Could you give some reflections on ignoring this aspect, please?
Okay. In few of time?
Sorry?
In few of time, I'll...
In few of time, yeah, sorry. So any prospect of reversing or reopening Brexit... will only happen, and there's no prospect of having a, as a lot of people talk about, having a referendum on the sort of terms of departure. None of that will happen unless MPs say no to Theresa May when she puts the deal to the House of Commons towards the end of this year. So there's no route, there's no exit to Brexit which does not start with a parliamentary rejection towards the end of the year. So, in the chronology of these things, the most important thing is to first encourage the legislature, MPs, to withhold their consent. After that, it's actually very difficult to predict what might happen, because, of course, if that were to happen, there would be a constitutional paralysis and gridlock in the United Kingdom, because the legislature would not agree with the government. Who knows, maybe Theresa May would have to resign, maybe they need another general election. It's really very difficult. But if that doesn't happen, then, as you know, the clock keeps ticking and the UK leaves at midnight on the 29th of March 2019 under the terms of the so-called Article 50. And so I think the most important steps in this sequence would be MPs say no. Then I think it would be very important that the UK, obviously with hopefully the consent of the rest of the European Union, pleads for more time. Because there's absolutely no way that the United Kingdom can kind of get itself out of this cul-de-sac that it's found itself into under the kind of mad pressure of doing it all by the 29th of March 2019. So we need more time. And then I hope over time it would be possible, perhaps by way of a referendum on the terms of the deal rejected by Parliament, to give the British people another say. And if that were the case, I mean, look, pretty well every prediction I've made about British politics over the last 10 years has been wrong, so including about my own future. So don't take my my attempt at future gazing very seriously. But I think there'd be a very strong chance that the referendum would then lead to a significant majority in favour of staying. As long as I said earlier, and as I've stressed enough, as long as there have been some changes on this vital issue of immigration, freedom of movement, partly because it's now so obvious that everything the Brexiteers said has turned out to be untrue. We're not getting £350 million for the NHS. There isn't this utopia of new trade deals for the UK, all that kind of stuff. But also, frankly, because of the generational change. I think young people would come out in huge numbers because they feel quite rightly cheated this time. And also, I think, because quite a lot of older voters, and I say this really anecdotally from what I've heard, kind of realise that, you know, it's quite a big thing to say to your kids, your grandkids, that they cannot have the future that they want. And so I think the generational seesaw would propel the vote towards a different outcome. By the way, just on that, there is no other democracy in the modern era, at least not that I'm aware of, that has done what the United Kingdom has done. In other words, to take such an abrupt and radical decision about its own future against the explicit and stated wishes of those who have to inhabit the future, the young. I mean, it's never happened anywhere else. And so for that reason, I think it is reversible. And finally, I don't want to sound sort of wise with hindsight, because it is totally understandable given the history that I described earlier. In other words, that there had never been much emotional, poetic, heartfelt content to Britain's commitment to the European community. You know, in a sense, you can't blame Cameron and Osborne and others in just sort of maintaining that tradition. And also, if you know, this endless cottage industry of opinion pollsters and so on would have told David Cameron and the other leaders of the Remain campaign that there isn't much affection There isn't much heartfelt affection for the European Union or for Brussels in the UK. There just isn't. In other words, I think the conclusion they not unsurprisingly would have arrived at, which is that the best way to explain to people why we should stay is a sort of hard-headed, it's kind of, you know, that's the way to keep your kids in work, that's the way to keep the economy ticking over, that's the way to keep more money in your pocket. And so, I think it was wrong, but I understand why they did it, because the evidence was overwhelming that there wasn't much sentiment to play with. The irony, by the way, is, here's the great irony, I will leave on this point, is that the heartfelt, more passionate conviction amongst some, in fact, quite a large number of Brits that we should stay in the European Union has only really come to life after we decided to leave. And it's often the case, isn't it? It's the case in our private lives, in everything, is that you start to miss something, you start to weep about something after you've thrown it away. And exactly that has happened in the UK. And I hope, particularly the younger voters who feel really quite worked up about this now, don't lose their passion for it. And if they don't lose their passion for it, I think in the long run there's always hope that it can be reversed and reopened. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. No. Alphabet.
Well, thanks to Nick Clegg for his brilliant speech, nice answers, but foremost for his homework to Europe, that is that we now have to rethink what we would like to do in the coming years. So that's also one of the things which we here on the continent need to discuss and debate in the coming years. And time is ticking. Macron is still here for 3 years and then he might be out. So thank you very much for your attention and thank you. Dames en heren, het college is nog niet helemaal afgelopen. Mijn studenten kunnen nog even meedoen aan de laatste Kahoot. Je gaat gedaan. Oké, graag gedaan. Dames en heren, voor degenen die nog hier in de zaal zitten, pak uw device, ga naar Kahoot en de pin voor vandaag is 7914436. En dit keer graag nette namen. Zo, daar gaat hij dan. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Ja. Wie nog? De laatste. Eenmaal, andermaal. Goed zo, Bas. Dan gaan we nu van start. De eerste vraag is om er even in te komen om de vingers naar deze lange talk te oefenen. En die is... Wat gaan we doen? Dus jammer dat Neglect nu vertrokken is. Dan had hij nog een opsteker mee kunnen krijgen. Nou, even kijken. Ja, 87. Nee, 26. Dus eigenlijk vinden we dat ze toch wel erbij horen. Dat vind ik wel fijn. Misschien kunnen we dat nog even doorgeven aan hem. Oké. Okay. Nou, dit is nog even was om de snelheid te testen. Maar nou gaan we zeg maar even naar de serieuzere vragen toe. Dus let even op, daar komen ze. Ja, goed zo. De volgende, wat hoort niet in dit rijtje thuis? Let op. Raad van Europa hoort hier niet bij. Goed gedaan. Waaruit blijkt dat de EU supranationaal zou kunnen zijn? Het Europees Parlement. Ah, ja. Nou, dat was wel zeg maar een lastige. In ieder geval, Tomasi ligt aan kop, gevolgd door Hanna. Maar we zijn nog niet helemaal klaar. Wat zegt het intergouvernementalisme over de oorzaak van meer Europa? Precies, waar is die? Daar! Politici zijn de oorzaak. Leroy aan kop, we gaan door. Welke volgorde is juist voor EU-beleid op basis van richtlijnen? Richtlijnen, let op. Welke volgorde is juist? Nou, ja. Omzetten, uitvoeren, controleren, handhaven. Dat stond ook op de slide. Heb je goed onthouden. En daarmee het goede antwoord gegeven. Hanna ligt dan aan kop. Nummer 7. Hoe kan het Nederlands parlement vooral Europese integratie sturen? Ja, dat is hem. Het behandelvoorbehoud. Hanna nog aan kop. Gaan we naar de voorlaatste vraag. Wat houdt de subsidiariteitstoets in? Goed zo. Het goede antwoord is de rode. Nou, nu komt ie. De laatste vraag. Hanna, gevolgd door Sebastiano en Tomasi op de derde plaats. Houden ze dat vol? Let op. Nu komt erop aan. Wat is juist over het Brexit-referendum? We hebben er een half uur over gepraat. Thank you. Dit is het goede antwoord. Het was een miniem verschil. Tada, Sebastiano. Waar zit Sebastiano? Gefeliciteerd. Hartstikke goed, Sebastiano. Mooi gedaan. Ik moet straks even bij me langskomen. Heel goed. Dit was het college. Hartelijk dank voor jullie komst. En volgende week zijn we er weer.